listening to a Lilith podcast. You can subscribe to Lilith Magazine, independent, Jewish, and frankly feminist, at www.lilith.org, where you can also find the Daily Lilith blog, other great podcasts, information on ordering back issues, and much, much more. Just click on www.lilith.org. Hi, Lilith podcast listeners. You're about to be privy to something very special. Excerpts of lectures given by three scholars of American Jewish history and an exclusive event held by Lilith Magazine and the American Jewish Historical Society on the 12th of April, 2010. We hope you enjoy these special selections. For more information, go to www.lilith.org.
You have Hasia Diner's bio in your kits, and we had it read aloud. You were introduced, Hasia, okay, by Susan Melbourne in a very lovely way. Without further ado, Dr. Hasia Diner.
I'm sure that Susan Melbourne was kinder and more effusive than she ought to have been. Okay, well, I want to thank Susan and Evan and Lilith and Susan Wiedemann Schneiderman on inviting me to be here. And it's really such so impressive to see such a large group of people taking that, group of women taking time out of their day to think about Jewish history for a couple hours. It's really very impressive. Now, I'm going to offer one caveat before I begin, so that I don't want you to think I'm misrepresenting myself. This period of time that I'm talking about, what we usually refer to as the colonial period or 18th century, is not my area of specialty. Indeed, I'm almost a little embarrassed that I have such an authority as Deborah Cashmore sitting there. This is not the field that I've worked in most closely with in terms of primary documents. Since we all who teach American Jewish history, teach this period and supervise students working in it, and certainly I've written about it in the context of a sort of synthetic history of the Jews of the United States, I feel pretty confident about it, but the level of my knowledge of the primary sources will not approach Annie's on the latter part of the 19th century, which is her area of specialty. So, and in a way, it's too bad because this, in some ways, is one of the most fascinating periods in American Jewish history. It's fascinating, I'd say, on a number of levels, all of which lead me to say that this is a field that really needs so much more scholarship and so much more attention. And first, it's fascinating because it was so small. I mean, we're talking about such a tiny community. By the eve of the American Revolution, there were probably under 2,000 Jews in the United States. Okay, what becomes the United States. So its smallness, in a way, should make it a really fertile field for research. Okay, because when we talk about the end of the 19th century or the 20th, we're talking about millions of people, and all you can do is you can generalize and you can talk about some individual instances, but you really can never talk about everybody. Okay, here's a period of time when the numbers are small enough that one could, in fact, get a really intimate peek into their lives, the kinds of communities they built, and in our case, the role of women. Okay, in a way, it's kind of analogous to some of the most exciting scholarship when I was in graduate school was on in the colonial period on the so-called New England town. That was a very popular subject in the 1970s, and it was these were exciting because these were minuscule communities. Okay, and therefore, it was really possible for historians to excavate the kind of connections between people and the way their lives progressed. The other thing that obviously makes this a fascinating time period is that it's the beginning. Okay, that is, there is nothing there for Jews to the Jews who are coming into the British. Well, first Dutch, but then the if we're talking about New Amsterdam, New York, but the, mostly it's in the main, it's the British colonies. There was nothing waiting for them in the way of Jewish life, and so whatever they developed on their own. Okay, in conjunction with Jews around the world, because it's certainly very much tied to the Jews of the Caribbean and to the Jewish communities in London and Amsterdam. You're all very much connected to each other. But these women and men who show up in the North American colonies build from literally the ground up. And so I think that from a historical point of view, it's really fascinating. So I got to hear a little bit of your questions to Annie, and certainly the one that was, well, what was the relationship between the Jews who were already resident in the United States with the immigrants? Did they serve as models? These people I'm talking about today had nobody. Okay, and so they truly fit into our category of pioneers in the sense of having a kind of set of tasks at, in front of them and having pretty much nothing to guide them in how to go about doing it. And so, and again, from a kind of the point of view of historical scholarship, I find that really fascinating. And I'm always trying to encourage more and more students to do research in this field and to define it as a really important area. So without more prefatory remarks, which I've probably spent more time on than I ought to have, let me make some overall statements about women in these early Jewish communities, and then make reference to the amazing documents that exist in this collection in the American Jewish Historical Society that are really almost the only, there's almost the only repository of material in the United States and in the world that tells us about these people. So it's, there's really, there's no comparison between what exists here and any place else. So generally, we actually do know very little about the Jews of this period, women or men, partly because the documents are pretty ephemeral. Okay. Sometimes Jews showed up in the official transcripts of the various colonies. Okay, so they could be kind of cherry-picked out of that. Jews wrote wills. Okay, and historian Leo Hershkovitz has done an amazing feat in terms of identifying wills that Jews wrote. And from the wills, you get to know about their property, you get to know about their class status, their familial relationships, to whom do they leave what, okay, whom do they exclude from their wills, okay, who gets written out. That is, who are they squabbling with in the family, and the like. There were numerous, well, sometimes, where there would be inventories of estates, okay? And so it's, again, fascinating to see what, you know, how many dishes they owned and what kinds of furniture they had and what paintings they had and the like. Paintings brings me to another way in which we understand these people, is that there were some notable portraits painted of the Jewish women and men of the, particularly the period just around the American Revolution, and how they presented themselves for the portraitist gives us a kind of insight into their world. They clearly founded institutions. They founded synagogues in the five cities in which they lived. And so let me just rattle them off. And they obviously all share a very prominent characteristic. Going from north to south, there were communities in Newport, New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, and Savannah. Okay, and then by the eve of the American Revolution, a small community is founded in Richmond. Okay, but these were the Jewish communities that existed, and among the other traits that they shared is that they were all ports. Okay, and so the Jews of this period fall into a class of people that historians have now begun to have identified and think about as port Jews. That's a kind of category. And so by definition, port Jews are involved in international trade. Okay, they're being living and being physically being present on the wharves and in the docks were crucial because these colonies, as well as places like Venice or Livorno and the like, functioned as part of a transatlantic world of trade. Okay, and so the Jews of North America in the colonial period were port Jews. Generally, historians who have written about port Jews also emphasize how port Jews tended to enjoy more in the way of rights than non-port Jews. And now, obviously, for the North American colonies, there were no non-port Jews. So let's say the Jews of Livorno have, again, a set of rights that was very much predicated on their important role in trade. They had more rights than the Jews who lived in Rome, okay, or in Florence, okay, who were not port Jews, okay, but by virtue of their trading, they had certain privileges. Okay, obviously, within the North American context, all Jews were port Jews. Now, there were some Jews, it is important to keep in mind, who we can't talk about at all and who kind of exist almost as sort of little traces hovering above the picture, and these were the outliers. Okay, so we know there were Jews in the colonies living beyond the hubs of Jewish life in those five communities, and at times there were relationships between them and the Jews in the community, but mostly they we would say they don't count because they weren't part of the community, and their not being part of the community also means they didn't leave much. If none of these people left a lot of a paper trail, those people left even less. Okay, so again, we know about Jews through those contexts. We should also know that we know about them through partnerships they entered into with each other, and these became then legal documents, these sort of instruments of partnership. They sometimes went into partnership with non-Jews. Okay, they had all sorts of business relationships with non-Jews, and as in, I've never been in business myself, but I presume that I'm of the impression that whenever one is in business, one also ends up in court, and that some of what we know about them emerges from court records, where a Jewish merchant will sue a non-Jewish merchant, or a Jewish merchant will sue another Jewish merchant, or a non-Jewish merchant sues a Jew, or a customer, and so on. So these provide us with details of their life. So again, some characteristics overarching. These were tiny communities. I mean, really, really small. They were part of a kind of Atlantic world. Okay, so a Jew living in New York was often in a business relationship with a Jew in Jamaica, who might, and the two of them together, had business dealings with a Jew in London and another one in Constantinople. Okay, so they're part of a kind of trading world. Well, the Constantinople guy is obviously not in the Atlantic world, but they're part of this connection. When the Jewish synagogue in Sheirith Israel is opened in New York, the Jews of Jamaica send them a Torah scroll. So that they're involved in a kind of religious exchange. Their marriages are around the Atlantic world. Okay, so a young Jew living in Charleston is as likely to have a good chance for marrying somebody in Barbados, okay, or in Curacao or Suriname or London, okay, all around the Atlantic basin, and obviously trade as well. Notably, there were no rabbis. Okay, there are no religious authorities, and we should keep in mind the first rabbi does not come to the United States until 1840. Okay, so until then, it is a rabbi-less community, and even after 1840, it's pretty spotty, hit or miss if there are rabbis present. And so, among other things, the question became how to make legal decisions, since we know so much of Jewish life is based around Jewish law and how it should be applied in one circumstance or another. And we could say that the Jews of this Atlantic, of the early American colonies, had two relationships to Jewish law. And one was if they had a problem, they communicated with rabbinic authorities in Amsterdam or London and asked for an opinion. And the other is they improvised. Okay, there will be questions, for example, of a Jewish man who is married to a non-Jewish woman. Where could their child die? Where would the child be buried? Could the child be buried in a Jewish cemetery? Well, I can't really wait until the letter ends up and gets to London and comes back. And indeed, the chances of the ship sinking were pretty great. And something has to be done. So there's a lot of improvisation. And in some ways, I find this really interesting because I see this setting the tone of Jewish life in America, which is one in which Jews feel that consider themselves either having to or and eventually entitled to interpret the law as fits their circumstances. Okay, so again, it's an outpost community. It's dependent on Europe. If they need a prayer books, if they need a Haggadah, if they need any kind of clay Kodesh, it has to come from someplace else. Now, we tend to think of this as the so-called Sephardic period, and certainly all the synagogues, which were founded in five cities, five synagogues, and there was each one had one synagogue only, okay, and I'll come back to that in 1 minute, but each one of those synagogues operated along the Sephardic rite, okay, and the records of these synagogues were kept for long periods of time in Portuguese, okay, since that was the dominant language. But notably, it was in a sense a Sephardic period only briefly, and by the 1740s, a majority of the Jews living in the colonies were actually Ashkenazim from northern Germany, from northern Poland. Many of them are Yiddish speakers, and one of the original 23 who have this kind of mythic role in American Jewish history, a bit overstated, but one of them seems to have come from Vilna. Okay, so the idea that this is purely Sephardic is fits the fantasies of kind of later writers of history, rather than reflecting the realities of life. And again, I'm going to come back to that also. So as I said, each community had only one synagogue. That one synagogue was the only Jewish institution. So the synagogue was the place where one got kosher meat. The synagogue was the place where one got married and buried. It provided the circumcision, matzah at Passover, education for children, charity for the poor. There weren't any extra synagogal institutions. Okay, and the 19th century basically begins in American Jewish life when the first city, and it was Philadelphia, has the first second synagogue. Okay, because then now you have competition. Okay, and also when the first, and I believe it was a charitable institution, was founded outside the orbit of the synagogue. Okay, so where somebody, a Jew, could get charity and didn't have to be part of the synagogue, because in the period we're talking about, the synagogues had a total monopoly on all things Jewish. Okay, so somebody needing charity, needing, wanting kosher meat, wanting matzah, had to be part of the synagogue community. Okay, and again, I think that we'll see that that's, I think, a very important characteristic. Whatever squabbling goes on within the community, and there certainly was a lot, it focused on the synagogue, and the synagogue elders, usually known as Parnassim, at least believed they had the right to exert a great deal of control over the lives of the members. And again, because the members had no place else to turn. Okay, in terms of class, and I'm going to get to women very quickly, this seems to have been a fairly well-off community. Okay, although they spent a lot of time talking about charity for the poor, probably most of the recipients of that charity were new incoming people, primarily from, again, northern, from Germany and Poland, although often via London and Amsterdam. Okay, so it was a kind of multi-staged migration, but most of them did fairly well, and we know this because they paid more taxes than the average, okay, and that meant that they had more property. Okay, there's no sales tax. People are taxed only on property. And their wills and inventories that have been left indicate that they were better off than most other New Yorkers or Philadelphians or Charlestonians or the like. And that's even when they're compared to white residents. Okay, obviously slaves are outside of the point of comparison. Okay, of the extraordinary people that we know about from this period, one was a woman, and her documents will be in the boxes that you're going to get to see. And so perhaps by thinking about her and talking about her, we get something of a larger picture of women's lives. Okay, and her name was Abigail Franks. Okay, and we know about her from yet another source, of which there are precious few, but the ones we have are therefore so valuable, and they are here. And these are letters she wrote to her children. Okay, so those letters, for one thing, again, are an insight into that Atlantic world, because her kids don't all remain close by so that she can talk to them every day. But by definition, as international traders, as involved with global business, they have to go elsewhere. Okay, and also marriage is on a kind of... tell me, should I stop while you pass around? Okay, I'm going to follow whatever instructions you give me. So she left a set of letters to her children. And so these are probably the most intimate peek we have of not just women's lives in the colonies. She's in 18th century New York, but of any Jew's life in the colonies. And so here I'm going to make a little plug for women's history, inasmuch as we tend to think of women's history as somehow about women. Okay? But the fact is, women's history is about the history of a community or of a group of people in a particular time, in a particular place. And we don't learn about women from women's history. We learn about 19th century Philadelphia, 20th century Pittsburgh, whatever. And now it may be that women were at some point or another more likely to write about or be involved in certain kinds of issues, but it is still probably one of the best windows onto the past is to look from the point of view of women. And because they seemed, I don't want to make an overly generalized statement, but because they wrote about personal matters, family in particular, and feelings, we actually learn a lot. We learn more about men from women's work, okay, from women's history, than we learn about either men or women from general history, which really is not about, you know, we can find out a lot about, you know, treaties and political action, but not about people's emotional or familial lives. Okay, so Abigail Franks, in these letters, gives us one of the most intimate portraits and extensive portraits of Jewish life in the 18th century. And its connections between that and family and trade and religion and politics and the like. So something very quickly about her. She was born in London, the daughter of Moses and Richa Levy. She married at the age of 16, a man named Jacob Frank, had 8 children, only 4 of whom survived, which was very typical of that time period. She and her husband were politically and socially extremely well connected. Okay, there we get, you know, that sort of this Jewish elite. They hobnobbed with the best and brightest, the cream of New York society. He was particularly active in politics, and she had a great deal to say about it in her letters, which kind of already interesting. So although she had no political rights, that didn't mean she wasn't a political player. Okay, she wrote about it, she talked about it with her friends and the like. I don't know how you'll feel about the next thing I'll tell you about her politics, but it was the case. She was very pro-British, and New York Jewry really kind of, as the Jews of the colonies generally divided in the age of the American Revolution between pro-British and pro-patriot. Okay, and the Jews actually had benefited a great deal from British trade, from British rights. Okay, Jews in the British colonies in North America had more rights than Jews in England. So they like the British, and so they were not, you know, I think we probably would like to think of them as all as patriots marching out with the fife and drum, but in fact, any number of them were quite active Tories. She was very pro-British. Okay, she was very well educated. She writes in her letters about all of the literary trends, the philosophic trends of the world around her. And she used her letters to talk about her social, literary, and cultural life. Okay, so I'm going to quote from some of her letters now. And meanwhile, you're looking at them. And, I mean, I think they're such awesome documents. Okay, despite the fact that they're so difficult to read. And again, I think these are just such haunting connections to the past, to see these documents. Anyhow, so what were some of her attitudes? Okay, well, first, she's religiously observant. Okay, she cared a great deal about kashrut, about Shabbat observance. She writes to her sons who are abroad, telling them to remember to be careful what they eat, to remember to observe Shabbat. Okay, she, despite her high level of integration into New York society, is meticulous in her observance of Shabbat, of Jewish law. But on the other hand, she's a real religious skeptic. Okay, and this, I think, is particularly interesting because she's really thinking about some of the philosophic implications of Judaism as a religious system. So in one of her letters, this one, you know, to a son, she read a book about religion, and she said she was sure that the author of the book was not Jewish because, quote, he thought too reasonably. Okay, and then she goes on and she say, that she could not, quote, she can't help condemning the many superstitions we are clogged with, and I heartily wish, now here this is great, heartily wish a Calvin or Luther would rise amongst us, okay, for I don't think religion consists of idle ceremonies, okay, and works of supererogations, which, if they send people to heaven, we and the papists have the greatest title to. In other words, Jews and Catholics subscribe to all sorts of idol ceremonies and don't ask a lot of questions about we do. She, again, in her letters to her sons, questions certain concepts within Judaism. So, again, she can't question them unless she knows them. So in one letter, the father-in-law of one of her sons died, and he obviously was very distraught. And now, obviously, in the Jewish tradition, there is this belief in Techiyat HaMetim, that the resurrected, that someday, you know, when the Messiah comes, the dead will be resurrected, which is obviously based on faith in two things. You know, one, that there's going to be a Messiah, and secondly, that after that entity comes, this resurrection will take place. And she said, she totally rejected that idea, and she says, all the differences after death is a man's work here on earth, for that never dies. And he or she that has left so great and good a name may be said to have lived full days and died in good old age. Yet, she goes on to say, there's no resurrection of the dead. Okay, what matters is the name that you leave in this world. And for us, again, I think it's kind of haunting because she obviously had no idea how much her name would be left for us several centuries later. Okay, she's an avid synagogue-goer, and so I'm going to pause for a second and note this is one of the remarkable characteristics of 18th century American Jewry, and it sets a pattern that will go on into the 21st, is that women attended synagogue in huge number. Now, synagogue going in Europe was a man's activity, okay, and women randomly, sometimes showed up, but it was not their place. North America, both before and after the Revolution, was a place where Jewish women defined the synagogue as their space, their balcony, their section, But they were there, and I can't remember if it was Woody Allen or somebody else who said showing. Maybe it was Joe DiMaggio. What was his name? The baseball player who made all those crazy comments. Yogi Berra, right? And obviously not my specialty either. I don't remember who said it, but you know, showing up was the most important thing. Okay, and these women were showing up to synagogue, and you know, the men had assigned seats based on class status. Okay, so the rich people had the eastern wall and had the better seats, and then the poorer you got, the worse your seats. And the women's seating replicated the men's seating. Okay, women sat, in a sense, in an analogous position to their husbands vis-a-vis and fathers vis-a-vis class and position in the community. And so she goes there often, and she consistently complains in her letters about what goes on in the women's section. And she said what went on there was, quote, a variety of news and tattle. I never am concerned, and I don't care to trouble myself about what those what the women were saying. Okay, she likewise was particularly turned off to the sort of intra-Jewish sparring that went on between the Ashkenazim and the Sfaradim. She thought it was really ridiculous, and she was herself an Ashkenazi. Okay, so she put the fault with this with the Sfaradim, and she said she wrote twice in letters to her son. She said, "quote the Portuguese here are in a great ferment." Okay, and now what were they in a ferment? Because and you have the Susan, do you have the Sisius material here also? Okay, sorry. Well, in this community, there was a marriage that took place between a Sfaradi, Isaac Mendes Sisius, and Rachel Levy, who was actually a cousin to Abigail Levy Franks. And as the comment was made by another observer, that when this wedding took place, quote, the tongues wagged. Okay, and she, Abigail Frank, said it was really the Sfaradim who were really kind of behind the bad talk. Okay, I guess the Lashon Hara about this, and she thought it was just appalling that the Portuguese were fomenting a kind of bad rap for Isaac Mendes Sisius for marrying an Ashkenazi woman. Now, again, because we want to get a window into this world, what's notable is that that marriage probably would not have taken place in either Amsterdam or London, where the Ashkenazim and the Sfaradim had separate synagogues. Okay, they even had separate cemeteries. And the bylaws of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam and in London both said that a Sfaradi man who married an Ashkenazi woman was expelled from the congregation. Okay, here again it's kind of like an interesting way in which thinking about something like marriage gives us an insight into the North American condition. It was such a small community that even though tongues wagged, they had to kind of stay together. And notably, the child of that union becomes the first notable American Jewish leader, Gershon Mendes Sisius, who is the becomes the Chazan at Sherif Israel and represents the Jewish community. For example, there was a parade that accompanied George Washington's inauguration as first president. Obviously, he was here. He was then in the seat of government was in New York. And Gershon Mendes Sisius marched with the chief Protestant clergy representing the Jews. And so he begins in this kind of sort of problematic situation as the child of a somewhat controversial union, and becomes the leader of American Jewry, or certainly New York Jewry. She also wrote in thinking about the commenting on the behavior of the women in the balcony, that the she saw what was going on, again, as idle chatter, and she had no problem exposing this, at least, or commenting upon this to her sons in her letters. She also, as I mentioned before, was very pious herself, and was constantly reminding her sons about their religious obligations, okay, about particularly Shabbat and Kashrut. Now, we know about Abigail Franks from these letters, not only because of all of these, you know, her commenting on the what went on in the synagogue and the idle gossip, and also she also wrote about the books she read and the dinner parties she went to, and who she invited over to her home, all that, again, fabulous material. But we have two really interesting stories that emerge from her life that these letters tell us about that no other document could. And this is that two of her children end up marrying outside of the Jewish community. And what she had to say about this was very significant as an insight into this world. So first, her daughter Phila married a man by the name of Oliver Delancey. Okay, I'm not sure if it was pronounced Delancey. It was a French name. I'm sure it didn't sound that way, but we know where he owned land, and he obviously gets immortalized in this city through the name of a major thoroughfare. And there's obviously something a little ironic or amusing or humorous that this became, you know, the kind of commercial heart of the Jewish Lower East Side was Delancey Street. And so when we have Joan Micklin's Silver's wonderful film Crossing Delancey, I always think about Oliver Delancey and how he might react if exhumed to this. Well, he was the member of one of the most prestigious, politically connected, wealthiest families in colonial New York, and Phila ran off with him. She didn't tell her parents because she knew that this was truly a taboo a thing to have done, and she actually lived in her parents' home for 6 months while married, secretly married to Oliver Delancey. But then, you know, the word it comes out that she'd married, and this was a huge problem for Abigail, and her letters, particularly to her son Naftali, were just so heart-wrenching. And so she just felt, actually, before I read some stray comments from her letters, a number of her non-Jewish friends, because again, she has a very wide social network, tried to tell her not to be so upset, because he was a person of tremendous worth, that he was a terrific person, and that she should really only think about Phila's happiness. And she couldn't do it. Okay, so here she is writing to Naftali that she was, quote, so depressed that it was a pain for me, to speak or see anyone. And that she believed she would never in her life ever again have or enjoy, quote, that serenity and peace which within I have so happily had hitherto. Okay, she stayed in her house. She wouldn't go out. Okay, and she says, my house has been my prison. Okay, and Oliver didn't want to see her. He wanted to make amends, and he wanted to reach out to her and kind of open up. I don't. They probably wouldn't have used this kind of language. We were channels of communication between him and Phila and the family. She refused to meet with him, and she said, however, if she did meet him on the street, she would be civil. But he was not able. She would not let him into her home. And as she said, I am determined. I will never see nor let none of ye family go near her. referring to phylum. So that was that. Okay, now, interestingly, Jacob Frank, while he was, Franks was, all, needless to say, also unhappy about this, he, however, was less willing to completely cut off phylum, and he made sure that in his will, he protected her, and that her inheritance would not be compromised, and as Abigail wrote to the son, the father's goal was to keep her, to protect Phila, lest she be, quote, ill-used by her husband or relations, which at present is other ways. And so that we have this difference between the mother's reaction and the father's reaction. And certainly as a historian, I would never say who was right and who was wrong. That's, you know, obviously a totally personal judgment, but I think what this offers us is to see how modern their problems were, and what that that world, which was one about the porousness of boundaries between Jews and non-Jews. Okay, and then finally, as a last little statement about this, and then I'm going to open this up for questions. Another child, her son David, also married out. He married a woman. Let me just say one other thing about Jacob Frank and why he might have been a little bit more, what was going on. There were business connections between the Franks and the Delanceys. Okay. And, okay, so, you know, and again, I said that at the beginning, this was a group that functioned in the general world, particularly through trade. And if, you know, one could imagine a kind of total rupture of the Franks family with the Delanceys could have had real repercussions, you know, where it really hurts. Okay, so the son David, who was living in Philadelphia, married a woman, a non-Jewish woman there. He did not, like Phila, convert to Christianity, but his children were baptized. The woman he married was the daughter of a very important Pennsylvania politician. And Abigail reacted to David's intermarriage no differently than she did with Phila, and said, "If I can't throw him from my heart, I will, by my conduct, have the appearance of it." Okay, so again, it's really, obviously still loves him. Same thing with Phila, which said, "But he'll always be in my heart, but, you know, I cannot have anything to do with him." And again, she went on to say that his marriage was a fiery trial for her, and she would have nothing to do with the children. I think that these start, now there's so much more we could get out of the Abigail Frank's letters, and I want to turn this over to you for some questions, but I think the richness of this material is just really quite amazing, and there are so many research projects that are still to be done with this 18th century, these 18th century documents that I would say we historians have only begun to scratch the surface. And I think we historians, if not many other people, are so indebted to the American Jewish Historical Society for being the custodian of these materials and for keeping them so well for such a long time. So let me get your questions, and yes.
Can I just ask how and why we're so lucky that we have this particular set?
Okay, that's a good question. And Susan, she's taken up. Okay, now the family, you know, remained a very important one, and I believe that they kept them privately. And, you know, it's notable that when the American Jewish Historical Society was founded in the 1890s, it had as one of its first and foremost projects documenting early American Jewry. Okay, that is this colonial period, and for a very clear reason. They wanted to be able to demonstrate through historical material that Jews were not newcomers to America, but that they had been here as long as there was in America. Okay, and it's, by the way, in that period that this whole, you know, the 23 of 1654 story comes to it, occupy such a prominent place, because it served very important political and defensive purposes on the part of late 19th century American Jews who are concerned, who rightly are concerned about escalating anti-Semitism. If you had to pick one community to say this is going to represent the colonial or the 18th century Jewish experience and the one that was most influential, you talk about Charleston, New York was a kind of minor blip. Okay, in the transatlantic world, and it's New York, the New York that we know as, you know, it's the Empire City. It's really not until the 1820s and the building of the Erie Canal. So Charleston, on the eve of the American Revolution, was in fact the largest Jewish community in North America. So one of tremendous importance. It just so happens that the Franks papers are New York. Well, it's a very wealthy community. Okay, the Jews of Charleston are, in terms of the American Revolution, very integrated. I mean, they are very integrated, and they are very pro-revolution. Okay, so they, unlike the Jews of New York, which had a very strong, and the Jews of Newport were the most pro-Tory, the Charleston Jews were, their integration is very, very profound in terms of their moving in the top circles of Charleston society. Okay, what else can I tell you about them? They owned slaves, but then so did, by the way, New York Jews owned slaves. Okay, slavery was a the only Jews who didn't own slaves were those in Newport, and that's because slavery was illegal in the one colony was Rhode Island that didn't have slaves. Jews, so in that way, they're really kind of like all other Southerners, but they had the same economic profile as New York Jews in terms of being traders.
Were they Sephardic? I mean, with the Ashkenazi Sephardic split, how did that go?
Same thing, that it's founded as a the congregation there is Bet Elohim, Kehilat Kodesh Bet Elohim. It's founded as a Sephardic synagogue, but the population is a majority Ashkenazi very early. And, I mean, what's interesting about Charleston, and sort of beyond the scope of our talk, but the first effort at reform is in Charleston. And in the 1820s, a small group within Beth Elohim asked the Chazan, okay, because again, like New York, there's no rabbi, for certain changes. They wanted an English sermon. They wanted the service to be a little shorter. When their requests were rejected, they seceded from the congregation and had a short-lived, the Reform Society of Israelites, it was called, of Charleston. They're really interesting. I can tell you the other thing about Southern Jewry is that the Jewish community of Savannah, as you probably know, Georgia was a debtor's colony. Okay, now the Jews of Georgia, okay, were also sort of shall we say, at the bottom of London Jewish society, and the trustees of when word came out, the press and so on, that James Oglethorpe was bringing a group of and debtors. Now, we can know that a debtor could also be somebody who is a perfectly honest, hardworking, thrifty person who met hard times. Okay, obviously, our own economic era right now tells us many people who, lost a lot are no less hardworking and so on, but circumstance dealt them this blow. But when the London congregation of Bevis Marks, the Ashkenazi congregation, heard that Oglethorpe was taking a group of debtors to the New World, they said, "We've got some people for you also," and so that the there's an Ashkenazi, there's a Jewish contingent on that first group coming to Georgia, and they also represent that class of Jews who lived on or lived off of the charity of the congregation in London. And the idea was, you know, get them off to America. Land is basically free because it's free because they're taking it away from somebody else. And that's where somebody who cannot make it in England is going to have a chance.
How did women's relationship to history change over time? Did women understand that they were contributing to history, or were they kind of going along? Was there a
That's a great question. Okay, that's a great question. And, well, I mean, that's in a sense gets to the heart of the whole question of women's history. I mean, it's going to take me a minute because that's, I've never heard it phrased that way, and it's a fantastic one. I think that in the main, most of these women until the middle of the 19th century with the rise of the first women's rights movement didn't see themselves as independent actors. They saw themselves as playing a crucial role in their families, and while the family may then be an important unit in the community, they were the custodians of the community. The family. Women in this period that I'm talking about and beyond, Jewish women, all women, but Jewish women, let's say in particular, were economically very active. So there are lots of Jewish women in colonial North America who have independent businesses. So there's a woman, and again, we get a sense of like how one learns about history. There was a woman in New York named Hetty Hayes, who was a widow, and she ran a boarding house. Okay, and it was a kosher boarding house. We got this Jews coming in and out of the port of New York. And at one point, the trustees of Sheirith Israel, somebody gossiped and said she was serving unkosher food. And they wanted to, that was not allowed. And remember I said they had a monopoly on power. So they wanted to come and inspect her kitchen. And she said, absolutely not. You know, you trust my word, okay, or forget it, okay? And this comes out in the Sheirith Israel material. And so what's interesting is less the outcome of the squabble between Hetty Hayes and the congregation, but her kind of sense of, look, this is my business, okay? Literally, this is my business, and it's also my business. And she comes off to us, I think, as an incredibly modern person, okay? But now, did she have a sense of, that she was a historic actor? Whew. I mean, again, it's really such a good question. You know, let me give you maybe an analogy, and I don't know if it's going to work or not, but, you know, we had this remarkable, from about a century old earlier, three quarters of a century earlier, the memoir of Glickle of Hamelin. Okay, so she's the first Jewish woman to leave an autobiography or memoir. And she wrote this book just for her children as a kind of ethical document. She had no sense that anybody other than her children were going to read this at the time, let alone, 300 years later. Okay, and she, you know, she's remarkable. You know, she has trading relationships. She has business enterprises all over Europe. It's amazing the ground she covered, the number of things she's involved in. And she also comments, like Abigail Franks, on politics and and ideas. And but does she have a sense that would she have said, my recollections of this period, my recollections of the 30 Years' War or the Spanish refugees coming into Hamelin, into Hamburg, and so on. My observations are important. I don't think so. And
was it something that happened in some of the things you studied that you could see an actual moment when it
I was thinking about the late 19th century, and for example, the National Council for Jewish Women. One of the things they were doing is setting up study circles, and I think that they would study Gratz's history of the Jews, and I think that. It's not exactly answering your question, but it's an example of how in the late 19th century, as Jewish women were kind of in some ways coming into their own as leaders or as independent agents, the importance of history and cultivating a study of history to give them that launching pad, I think, comes into play.
You know, I'd almost say that one cannot think of oneself as being in history unless one has a sense of individual rights and a kind of entitlement to shape the kind of process on the ground. And so it's interesting that the National Council of Jewish Women comes into being, it was 1893, 1894 is the for the first time, a congregation in the world allows a woman to be a member. So in 1894, Mikveh Israel, one of the congregations that's founded in the colonial period, allowed a woman, or allowed women, to be voting members of the congregation. Okay, and so that sort of recognition of themselves wanting to know history is because I think they're beginning to see themselves as shaping the world in which they live, which then becomes the history that later generations will turn back to. But it's a very challenging question, and I could see that there's actually a book there.
Thank you for listening to this Lilith podcast. Check out the Lilith website for more podcasts, plus the Lilith blog, online anthologies, back issues, and much more. That's www.lilith.org.